This evening we're thinking about the question of Jesus and Muhammad. What's the difference and does it matter? And it's a great joy for us to have Rob Scott with us. This is Rob. Rob works for a church over in the city. He lives in the East End, where he's regularly involved in engaging better understanding between Christian and Muslim people. And before that, Rob spent some time living and working in Bangladesh and for the World Health Organization. So Rob, thank you very much for coming to talk to us this evening.
Thank you for that, Kev. And there's a meeting for better understanding between various Muslims and Christians tonight on the Isle of Dogs. And I should be there, but I'm here. I'm very glad to be here, Kev. Or I could be watching West Ham Liverpool, but never mind. Never mind. All of you should have a handout. I've got an A4 so I can read it. You've got an A5. It's a bit crammed, so it could be on four sides, but hopefully you'll be able to read it. Some idle thoughts to begin with. In a world of President Trump, I like going back to the West Wing. It's nearly 20 years old now when the West Wing began with President Jed Bartlet, a Democratic president. The very first episode of season one begins with some of President Bartlet's senior staff arguing with some Christians about various things that they've offended each other over. And at some point, they then start saying, well, you name the Ten Commandments, and none of them can really name the name the first commandment, and they're all struggling. And at that moment, President Jed Bartlet bursts through the doors and says, I am the Lord your God. Worship no other gods before me, as if that is the first commandment, and he is God in some ways. Now, those commandments were given to the prophet Moses on the top of Mount Sinai. And those commandments do say, have no other gods before me, make no idols. Sadly, God's people, the people of Israel, very quickly turn away from their God. They make a golden calf. You may know the story. They bow down to it as if this is the God that has brought them out of Egypt and rescued them in some way. Later on in Israel's history, up another mountain, there's another face-off between kind of God and the idols. The true prophet of God, Elijah, has a kind of battle of the prophets with the false prophets of Baal and says, whoever can bring down fire from heaven is the true God. The prophets of Baal call out to their God, but nothing happens. Elijah calls out to his God and fire comes down and the idols are destroyed and the prophets are killed. Fast forward a few thousand years to Palmyra in Syria. That settlement is about 3,000, maybe 4 or 5,000 years old, and at various times has worshipped various gods. ISIS, 3 years ago, destroyed some of the temples there. Christians, when they were there, in the 3rd century, destroyed some of the temples there that were to other gods, not the true God. Before we get to Palmyra, though, we have the Protestant Reformation in Europe, and that was against many gods of Europe. John Calvin, one of the leading reformers of the day, talked about people's hearts being a factory of idols. It's not just the case that people want to bow down to statues, but people will almost bow down to anything, will have anything that they think will fulfill their desires, that they want to follow more strongly than God. For some people of the day, that was Mary. They thought she was so special, she could bring them access to God, which they couldn't get any other way. They prayed to her. To other people, they would follow their just desires for power, for money. All these different things were things that people held on to as an idol instead of the one true God that President Bartlet talked about. Even one of our present-day prophets, Bob Dylan, says something similar. I personally don't think he can sing very well, but I think he is a good poet. I know that's not the right thing to say, but here's something he wrote. You may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble. You may like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls. But you're going to have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you're going to have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody. You might be a rock and roll addict prancing on the stage. You might have drugs at your command and women in a cage. You may be a businessman or some high-degree thief. They may call you doctor. They may call you chief, but you're going to have to serve somebody. It's not the language of idolatry, but it's the concept of idolatry. Everyone has to serve somebody else, is answerable to somebody else, is following somebody else, or something else in their heart. their goals, their ambitions, their self, the desire for comfort, the desire for love, for money, for power. Tim Keller, a church minister and thinker in New York, has written a book called Counterfeit Gods, with the strapline, "When the empty promises of love, money and power let you down." Our hearts want to follow after things that will give us stuff. We serve these things. Our lives are directed by them. But God says we should have no other gods before him. We'll come back to why I've started this way in a minute or two. But just some initial comments really about Muslim people, Christian people, Muhammad, Jesus, Islam, Christianity. A couple of cheesy posters nicked off the internet for you there. "Keep calm and love Muhammad." S-A-W, that's the English transliteration of the phrase, "Peace and blessings be upon him." Keep calm and love Muhammad. The Christians not to be outdone say, "Keep calm and love Jesus more." What I want this evening not to be is playground, competitive religious syndrome. My God's bigger than your God. My religion's better than your religion. I don't want it to be like that at all, and I hope I don't come across like that. Nor do I want it to be a case of self-censoring where we never, ever talk about these things because some people might get upset. I don't want to offend people. I don't set out to do that. Sometimes we do so unintentionally. But that unintentional offense shouldn't make us not say anything at all. These things are important. They matter. Some of you here may be thinking, well, Muhammad and Jesus, what's the difference? That they're just the same. Assalamu alaikum. The greeting for Muslim people, peace be with you. It's the same greeting that Jesus gave on Resurrection Sunday to his disciples, peace be with you. Maybe they're just the same. They talk about peace. They live out peace, you might be thinking. Or you might be thinking, what a load of rubbish. They may say peace, but look beneath that, and there's a whole lot of violence. Look at ISIS. Look at the Crusades. They say they're following their prophets. Look at the mess and the lack of peace. Or you may think, they're both utterly irrelevant, and you may wonder why you've come here tonight when you could be watching West Ham and Liverpool. In our nearly Brexit world, in our world that might be about to burn up in 5 years' time, if Greta is right, how can these two people be relevant in any way at all? There are some similarities between Jesus and Muhammad, undoubtedly. They both talk about God. They both claim to be prophets. They talk about sin. They talk about judgment. They talk about heaven. They talk about the kind of things religious people are expected to talk about. But they have some important differences. Some of those differences, I explore it in this book, Dear Abdullah, and there's some copies at the back if you'd like to take one away at the end. One rabbi has said that it's in differences and contrasts that we find wisdom and understanding. A silly example of that. Tomato is a fruit, like every other fruit. Oranges, apples, pears, bananas, pineapple, mango. But generally, we know the difference between a tomato and those other kinds of fruit and don't put it in a fruit salad. It's a silly example, but the difference matters, certainly for desserts. And I'd say that Muhammad and Jesus are both relevant. Understanding them both is relevant now, at least for conversations in our communities, and I think more than that. But also forever. Both claim there is a forever. There is something more than this life and should be listened to. So, what do you think of Muhammad? Here are some thoughts for you. And all but one of these thoughts are from Muslim references. And I put the reference down so you can chase it up afterwards because I don't want to be accused of abusing or misquoting out of context in any way. The first reference from a modern Muslim website. According to Islamic belief, the Prophet Muhammad was the last messenger of God. He, like all of God's prophets and messengers, such as Noah, Abraham, Moses, and Jesus, was only a human being. Christians came to the mistaken assumption that Muslims worship Muhammad by formulating an incorrect analogy. They worship Jesus, so they assumed Muslims worship Muhammad. This is one of the reasons that they called Muslims by the incorrect name Muhammadans for so many years. This modern website by modern Muslims is saying, no, we do not worship Muhammad. We're not like you Christians. We don't raise up Muhammad on a pedestal in that kind of way. And that agrees with some of the closest friends of Muhammad, as narrated in the Hadith. Here's one from Umar, who became one of the early caliphs, leaders after Muhammad. I heard the Prophet, I heard Muhammad saying, do not exaggerate in praising me as the Christians praise the Son of Mary. for I'm only a slave, so call me the slave of Allah and his apostle. So Muhammad is saying, look, don't do to me what those Christians have done. I'm not more than that. I'm just a slave, an apostle, a messenger of Allah. Over the page, another friend of Muhammad, Abu Bakr, at Muhammad's death said this, whoever amongst you worship Muhammad, Muhammad is dead. But whoever worships Allah, Allah is alive and will never die. Allah said, Muhammad is no more than a messenger. Many were the messengers that passed away before him. And Abu Bakr is quoting the Quran there. Muhammad's no more than a messenger. And that agrees with what the Quran says. Surah 18, for example, say, Muhammad is to say, I am only a human being like you, being inspired that your God is one God. Whoever hopes to meet his Lord, let him work righteousness and never associate anyone with the service of his Lord. In some ways, quite a good summary of Islam. Muhammad's only a human being, but he's been inspired. He's had the Quran given to him, inspiration from God. And if you want to meet God, you've got to be righteous. You've got to work righteousness in this life, and particularly never associate anyone else with God. Don't have more than one God, particularly you Christians. So he's just a man, and only a man. But I don't think that's the whole picture. Because the hadith, the writings about Muhammad, of what he said and did, also say things like, none will have faith until he loves Muhammad more than his family and all humanity. Muhammad is to be first in your heart, more loved than your parents, than your husband or wife, than your children, than anyone or anything else. Obedience to Muhammad is obedience to Allah, and disobedience to Muhammad is disobedience to Allah. You can't get a cigarette paper between them. Obey one and you're obeying the other. And then when you look at a couple of the foundational pillars of Islam, Muhammad is present there. The Shahada, the confession of faith that there is no God but God and Muhammad is his prophet. If you say that, you're a Muslim. That confession includes Muhammad alongside God. And the Salat, that the five times prayer includes, among other things, greetings to you, O prophets, the mercy and blessings of Allah. The first two important pillars include Muhammad alongside Allah, God. And whilst Medina is not an official place of pilgrimage alongside Mecca, many people do make it a place of pilgrimage alongside Mecca because Muhammad is buried there. Muhammad is also said to be the best example to follow. He is the supreme example to follow. Now, this is one non-Muslim quote I'm going to give you, but it's very positive towards Muhammad, which is why I'm using it. It's from a 19th century French historian, and I will read it in English because I can't read French. But about Muhammad, never has a man set himself voluntarily or involuntarily a more sublime aim, since this aim was superhuman, to subvert superstitions which had been interposed between man and his creator, to render God unto man and man unto God, to restore the rational and sacred idea of divinity, amidst the chaos, the material and disfigured gods of idolatry then existing. If greatness of purpose, smallness of means and astounding results are the true criteria of human genius, who would dare to compare any great man in modern history with Muhammad? Philosopher, orator, apostle, legislator, warrior, conqueror of ideas, restorer of rational dogmas, of a cult without images, the founder of 20 terrestrial empires and of one spiritual empire, that is Muhammad. As regards all standards by which human greatness may be measured, we may ask, is there any greater man than he? That's a 19th century historian. Then we have a poem from the Middle Ages, but it's actually based on a poem from maybe the 7th or 8th century about Muhammad. I've neglected the path of the one who brought black night to life by praying, meaning Muhammad, until even his feet swell with distress. To quell his hunger, he tightened his midriff by strapping stones to his soft sides and strong ribs. Lofty mountains, to entice him, draped themselves in gold. But he showed them a towering soul, perfectly content without desire. The extremity of his needs only confirmed his freedom from desire. Need never overshadows virtue that is firmly rooted. How could the need of such a man be answered by the world, when without him this world would never have come into being? Muhammad, Lord of both worlds, Lord of both species, Lord of both assemblages, Arabs and all others, our prophet, commander of rights, forbidder of wrong. No soul kept his word more justly, whether yes or no. He is the beloved whose intercession is hoped for as arms against a host of relentless calamities. He called on God. Whoever clings to him clings to a rope that will neither unravel nor break. His form and character surpassed even the previous prophets, and none have approached him in knowledge or nobility. Incomparable, his beauty has no peer. The essence of beauty itself is his nature. Leave aside what the Christians have claimed for their prophet. Then praise him as you like, but do so wisely. Ascribe to his essence what you wish of honor. Attribute to his exalted status what you will of greatness. Truly, the messenger of God's bounty cannot be overstated by two lips and a tongue. If a miracle could equal his stature in magnitude, the mere mention of his name would revive decaying bones. He's like the sun, small to the eye when seen from afar, but when glimpsed close up, it dazzles and overwhelms. The extent of what we know of him is this: he is a man, and yet without exception, he is the best of God's creation. All of the signs brought by the noble prophets before him came to them through his light alone. He is the bounteous sun, and they her orbiting planets. She reveals their lights for humanity in the darkness of night, until finally his light dawned on the horizon. And his radiant guidance suffused the world and brought life to countless civilization. What excellence lies in the birth of a prophet adorned with such character. Beauty itself shines forth from his smiling face. The guys I mentioned on the Isle of Dogs who are meeting at the moment, right now, we went through this poem together just before Christmas, and they agreed with what it was saying. If God had not created Muhammad, then he would not have created creation, one of them said. Creation is for Muhammad. Another said he is the mediator, the intercessor, par excellence, between God and people. They recognize a need for a mediator. No one can approach the holy God. Someone is needed to get in between you and God because we are sinful, and he is the guy. And this kind of thinking is true for most Muslim people that I've come across, whatever their background. I've just completed a master's in history at Queen Mary University, and my dissertation was a lot of fun, really, interviewing lots of people in Tower Hamlets. I was looking at the extent to which the Islam practiced by Muslim Bangladeshis in Tower Hamlets has changed over the last 50 years. And you did have differences between the different interviewees. You did have differences across generations. An older generation, for example, celebrated Muhammad's birthday. They thought that was really important. The younger generation said, no, you shouldn't do that. That's an innovation. It's wrong. That's being like Christians with Christmas. You shouldn't do that kind of thing. But both groups of people would agree with this poem and want to follow Muhammad as best they can. They're Sunni Muslims. Shia Muslims also would say the same. In many ways, they have the whole of the holy family of Muhammad on a pedestal. Muslim people are putting him front and center in their lives, and therefore we can understand why cartoons might be offensive. It would be offensive, wouldn't they, when you hold someone so dear and is so important? But I want to ask, isn't that idolatry? Isn't this exchanging the glory of the Creator for something or someone created? Creation is to show the glory of God, not the glory of the created. I know that's not what Muslim people would say or think, but when you read some of these things and see some of their lives, and know that Muhammad is the center of their heart, it looks like idolatry. But we do need a mediator, we do need an intercessor. But is he the right one? It's interesting, I mentioned earlier about the Reformation, and part of the Reformation was coming back to the scriptures, coming back to God and not needing any other mediator to take you to God. Mary had become a mediator. She'd become so special in Roman Catholic people's minds. She'd brought Jesus into the world. The Word had become flesh through her. She was very special and raised up. In some ways, I think my Muslim friends do the same for Muhammad. He has brought the Word into being, the Quran. And like Mary is raised up, I would say that's a form of idolatry. I'd also say, is this true and good? Not least because the sources about Muhammad So he was unsure that he was hearing from God. And if you want to look, I've got the books at the back here. At one point, he doesn't know where he is going or what will become of him. So is he a good person to follow and have in your heart? He also did no miracles. The Quran is clear about that. It says the Quran is his miracle, but he did no other miracles. And yet, when you read the Quran, it doesn't seem particularly miraculous itself and seems very earthly and time-bound and not the eternal book it claims to be. It's also clear over the page that Muhammad sinned, that he was not perfect. And so how can he bring you into the perfect God's presence? My Muslim friends do claim that he was sinless, but the Quran doesn't allow them to say that, I would argue. He also approved of mockers being killed. People that said and spoke various things against him, he ordered their execution. And again, it's in the Muslim history book there. Yes, they may have been propagandists, people that were trying to incite others against him, but he killed people who simply spoke words against him. He was also involved in 20 to 100 different skirmishes or battles. Some of them were defensive. He was a political leader along with being a religious leader. And in that regard, I think I can view him like every other leader. He did some good things and did some wrong things. He did some good things because he's made in the image of God, like all of us, and worthy of dignity and respect. But like all of us, he's fallen and does some wrong things. The greatest person in Britain is said to be Winston Churchill. He's on the £5 note. My Bangladeshi Muslim friends don't like the £5 note because of that. I didn't know much of this, but during the Second World War, it was Churchill's policies that led directly to a famine in Bengal, present-day Bangladesh. Churchill preferred to get food to white people than brown people. All of our leaders are flawed, however great they may be. So, what do you think of Muhammad? Is he someone that should be on a pedestal and in your heart and is the right intercessor for you? Is he worthy to be followed and functionally worshipped? There's a little booklet at the back put together by a Pakistani friend about who can save us on the Day of Judgment and whether Muhammad is a worthy intercessor. Please take that away if you'd like to. But let's move to Jesus, and then we will have time for questions as well. Jesus is born of a virgin, proclaimed by angels. He resisted temptation perfectly. He proclaims good news. He brought forgiveness and was authenticated by miracles. The first 8 chapters of Luke's gospel, for example, are very clear about these things. And my Muslim friends would, on the whole, agree with those things. But as we get to Luke chapter 9, there are real differences and difficulties that emerge between us. I'm just going to turn to that now. It's on page 1044 of the Bibles. But there are also Luke's Gospels at the back if you want to take one away at the end to read some more about this. We're on page 1044. We're not going to read it all in depth. But just as you're turning it up, the issue is really about Jesus' identity at this point. Jesus sent out some of his followers, and they've done the kind of things that he's been doing. He's given them power to heal people. And that's made a lot of others sit up and think, who is this guy that can give out power like that? King Herod thinks, is this John the Baptist come back from the dead? Is it another kind of prophet? The people of the day are also thinking, is this another kind of prophet? Is it Elijah? Is it Moses? Not least when Jesus does the kind of miracle that happened in Moses' day, the feeding of 5,000, just like Israel were fed in the desert near Mount Sinai. Ah, thank you, that's good. That's page 866. Thanks, Kev. We shall read from this one. And it's mostly on page 867. So it's all about who this Jesus is. And then left-hand column of page 867, verse 18. Now it happened that as he, Jesus, was praying alone, the disciples were with him. And he asked them, who do the crowd say that I am? And they answered, John the Baptist, but others say Elijah, and others that one of the prophets of old has risen. Then he said to them, but who do you say that I am? And Peter answered, the Christ of God. The word Christ there is a Greek word. It's the same as the Hebrew word Messiah, and it means anointed one. And way back in the previous prophets, in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew scripture, there had been promises of an anointed one, a king who he would be called. The anointed one would be a king, a long-promised king, who would rule with peace and justice, who'd be in David's line in 2 Samuel 7, who would be the place of refuge in Psalm 2, who would rule with justice forever in Isaiah 9. And so when Peter says you're the Christ of God, he's including all those ideas from the previous prophets. Let's read on, verse 21. And Jesus strictly charged and commanded them to tell this to no one, saying, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. Jesus here is claiming to be the Son of Man who will die and rise again. Again, the Son of Man is something from the previous prophets, this time from Daniel. The Son of Man is given great authority over the whole world forever. And when Jesus talks about dying and rising again, he's picking up another prophet, the prophet Isaiah from 700 years before, who talked about a servant who came to die and live again so that everybody could live. He would die the death that we all deserve, to take away the punishment we deserve for our sins. He's the long-promised global ruler and rescuer, the one who can bring us into God's presence like a mediator should do. But there's more than that. At the bottom of the page there from verse 28. Now about 8 days after these sayings, Jesus took with him Peter and John and James and went up on the mountain to pray. And as he was praying, the appearance of his face was altered and his clothing became dazzling white. And behold, two men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now Peter and those who were with him were heavy with sleep, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. And as the men were parting from him, Peter said to Jesus, Master, it's good we're here. Let us make three tents, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah, not knowing what he said. As he was saying these things, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. And a voice came out of the cloud saying, This is my Son, my chosen one. Listen to him. And when the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone. And they kept silent and told no one in those days anything of what they had seen. Jesus is up a mountain a bit like Mount Sinai, where Moses received the law. A mountain a bit like Mount Carmel, where Elijah had his face off with the false prophets. And he meets those two prophets, Moses, who brought the law, and Elijah, who enforced the law. But at the end, they're not there. He is there. He is more important than those prophets who brought and enforced the law. And Jesus, God's Son, verse 35, this is my Son, and knows where he is going. In verse 31, he's talking with Moses and Elijah about his departure. The Greek word behind that English word is Exodus, the second book of the Bible, which is about God's rescue of his people through acts of judgment. Jesus is speaking about his rescue mission that he knows is going on, that he will come through rescuing all kinds of people as he goes to his death and resurrection. But he's not just greater than Moses. He's not just God's Son and knows where he's going. He's God's chosen one and must be listened to. This is my Son, my chosen one. Listen to him. And yet those key things are things that the Quran takes out of Jesus, that Muhammad took out of Jesus. He is not God's Son, the best revealer of all, better than any prophet. He's so close to God, he can speak on God's behalf. Within the Quran, he is not the Son. And he's not someone that goes on a rescue mission. He doesn't die in the Quran. And without those things, you're not left with the real Jesus, taken out and replaced him. And in many ways, Muslim people have replaced him with Muhammad as the perfect intercessor in their mind, the perfect mediator, the one who should be followed and listened to. And yet all of us are doing this as well. If we're not following this Son and listening to him, we are following something else or someone else in our hearts. All of our hearts are idol factories, latching onto something that is not the Creator. It's dangerous to do that. Jesus talks elsewhere of what will happen at the end of time to those who aren't following the Creator. And yet Jesus is the true and better mediator. He can come perfectly between God and man because he was both God and man. And he fulfills the previous prophets in ways that nobody else ever had or has subsequently. And Jesus, therefore, is relevant now and forever. A few verses we missed out. Verse 23. And Jesus said to all, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and the holy angels." Jesus tells his followers to deny themselves, take up their cross and follow him, to serve other people, not themselves. Just think of the difference that would make to our families, to our communities, to London, if we were all denying ourselves and serving others, putting others in front of ourselves. Christians in past generations at the Crusades got this completely wrong when they thought take up your cross and follow me meant paint a cross on your tunic and go and kill people. That's not what this is about. It's about denying yourself to serve others. That's relevant now for our communities, but it's also relevant forever. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and the holy angels. What we think of Jesus now matters for eternity. So what do you think of Jesus? But I guess the more important question here is actually, what will he think of you? Will he be ashamed of you that he is not first in your heart?